Okay, I think it's 10 o'clock. Let's begin. Good morning, everyone. I'm Philip Shaw. I look after the economics team for Investec here in London. Welcome to the first of our Investec webinars on various aspects of the economy, which we are intending to hold every fortnight. It's good to see so many of you here this morning, and obviously, hope you're all keeping well. Now, it's the 1st of July, so we think it's an appropriate title for this session, which is the mid-year review. Pleased to say that we've got a real breadth of talent and experience here from within Investec to discuss various aspects of the economy and market. So I'll just introduce everybody briefly. I'll begin the session by saying a few words on the progress of the trade deal, or the lack of it, if you like, with the EU. After that, we will hear from another of our economists, Victoria Clark, who will look at the economy from the perspective of what's happening with the coronavirus. Then we'll move on to currencies with Kieran Russell, a director in our corporate foreign exchange team. We'll then hear from Kate Calvert, who heads up Investec's retail research on the equities side of the business. And wrapping up for us will be Paul Rablin, a director within the growth and leverage finance corporate lending team, who will talk to us about logistics. What we're going to do is to ask one or two questions after each speaker and then have a wider Q&A session at the end. Now, before I start, just a couple of housekeeping points. All of you will be kept automatically on mute. To submit a question, please use the Q&A feature. I think it's on the right-hand side of your box. Type the question and select all panelists or ask all panelists to submit your question to us. This is the first of our webinars of this type. We are aware that we can have technical issues. So if you do have any audio problems, please type and let us know in the Q&A section. And we've got an audio visual team that will contact you. And last, we're recording this session, just to let you know that. And also, our comments do not constitute investment advice. So let's have a few words on Brexit and the trade deal. And of course, the UK left the European Union on 31st of January this year. And where we are now is an agreed transition period until the end of this year. And during this, the relationship between the UK and the now EU27 stays largely as it was before. Now, there was the option of extending the transition period by either 1 year or 2 years, but this had to be agreed by yesterday, the 30th of June, and the government insisted that it did not want to extend the transition. So to look at the deal, let's dial back to what was struck between the UK and the EU last October. And there are two parts to it. The first bit was the withdrawal agreement, which was really the terms of the UK leaving the EU, and that's an international legal treaty. Secondly, you have the political declaration, and that sets out the intentions on the future relationship. Now, that's pretty sketchy. It's not a legal agreement, it's not a treaty, but the parties are obliged to negotiate the detail with what's called best endeavors. And the declaration seeks a free trade agreement working towards zero tariffs and quotas between the EU and the UK. The Prime Minister is trying to establish a looser relationship with the EU than Theresa May did. He's seeking to strike a bespoke free trade deal, several with third-party countries such as the US, Japan, and Australia, and to diverge from EU rules. Now, it's clearly a mountain to achieve in a short space of time, so why not extend the transition period? And really, there are two reasons. The first one is that the UK would need to pay, possibly in the region of around £10 billion per annum. Secondly, it was felt that the UK government, by extending transition, would simply be kicking the can down the road and would just lengthen negotiations without really getting anywhere. And if you look at the path of the actual Brexit negotiations after 2016, there's probably a large element of truth to that. The question is whether we are going to get a free trade agreement or an FTA, as in the EU-Canada deal, or if the relationship between the two is simply based on the withdrawal agreement, i.e. no trade deal. What happens if there's no deal? Well, it's quite a lot, but in terms of the economy, there are two big things from a top-down perspective we would point out. And the first thing is that Exports to the EU would be subject to its World Trade Organization, its WTO tariffs, which are particularly onerous in certain sectors, particularly food. UK tariffs would be levied on imports, though the recently announced UK global tariff means that various sectors would be rated at zero. And the second point is that shipments, especially those on trucks going in on roll in, roll off, would be subject to checks at the point of entry. And that brings forward the unwelcome possibility of long holdups. So in short, the risk of no trade deal being struck is of further damage to the economy, as we heard from a letter to the Prime Minister signed by 100 business leaders yesterday. The two sides have just started the first of 5 weeks of accelerated talks. Boris has actually indicated recently that he would like to see the trade deal struck by the end of July. We feel that is unfeasibly optimistic. Trade experts are suggesting that the next month, though, might show whether it's possible to determine if a deal can be struck by the end of the year. So what are the main sticking points? The biggest one by far is what's called the level playing field, or LPF, and that means sticking to EU rules on issues such as particularly government subsidies, but also climate change standards, animal welfare, and workers' rights. Primarily, the European Union is concerned about a third-party country on its doorstep gaining a big competitive advantage, and it's also probably concerned about potential competition from cheap imports from third-party countries, particularly food. So, quick point on financial services. The UK government has basically given up on passporting rights quite some time ago. Access to EU markets and vice versa will be based on judgments on whether regimes are equivalent. That was intended to be completed yesterday, but the UK hasn't apparently answered EU questionnaires yet, and UK is complaining that the EU is deliberately flooding it with paperwork to sabotage the talks. Where is all of this going? Well, you know, to be honest, it isn't precisely clear. We know from history that trade agreements are always complex, and quite frequently, one might argue almost all the time, there's never any settlement until the last minute. One point is that this time around, you cannot wait until late December to conclude the negotiations, because everything has to be ratified by various legislatures. And on the EU side, that might include individual European parliaments. So what we're probably aiming for to conclude the talks is sometime in October, November. We feel that despite the way that things are going at the moment, a sensible base case is that the UK and the EU agree on a broad set of parameters in time, and they both agree a light touch to product checks until all the fine print is settled, there's more infrastructure at the ports is ready. Are we being too optimistic here? We don't think that we are. By definition, of course, at the moment, the UK and the EU are already aligned on rules and product standards. So in practical terms, you have to say there are a few fundamental reasons to demand checks right now, at least on goods. And we would say also that the economic weakness and vulnerability stemming from the coronavirus will help to concentrate the minds of both sides to force an agreement. And trying to, or introducing material trade frictions when the economy is struggling is really not going to be very good for anybody. Another point is that leaders who are under pressure at home will not want to be held to account for failure. For example, in France, Macron's party has just suffered in local elections. And here, if you check the opinion polls, recent soundings have been showing Boris lagging behind Labour Party leader Keir Starmer in terms of approval ratings for the first time. So, you know, we don't know at this stage, there is a long way to go, but we do believe that an agreement will be reached in time. I have a question that's been put through already. Could you give us a little bit more detail on what happens to trade in goods if the UK and the EU fail to strike a deal? Pretty complex stuff. I did mention tariffs, but to give you a little bit more granularity, on exports, we would be facing EU most favoured nation tariffs. And in fact, this is the tariff schedule which we're using at the moment for imports from areas where we don't have an FTA, a free trade agreement. And as I said, on areas such as food, the EU charges, you know, an average of about 20%. But if you look at, I think lamb is, for example, 40%, that they're pretty substantial. Cars are 10%. On incoming tariffs, I did mention briefly that Westminster has compiled a new tariff list called the UK Global Tariff. It's actually removed tariffs on £30 billion worth of goods, mainly goods used in supply chains. Of course, these tariffs will only be for countries without a free trade agreement with the UK, and that would include the EU if no deal is reached. Now, the goods that aren't zero tariffed will include food and cars. And really what the UK is trying to do here is to say, if you don't strike a deal with us to the EU, then those tariffs are going to be high. They will be the same as your tariffs. So this is a tactic to try and gain leverage with the European Union. Also on the import side, what the government is planning to do is to introduce a light touch approach to paperwork from imports, including payment of tariffs as well. And that's got a striking resemblance to all the no deal planning that was being done last autumn as well. But of course, at the moment, that's not been reciprocated by EU countries. And it looks as though the UK exports at the moment would be facing not only tariffs if there's no deal, but lengthy checks at the port as well. So thank you to the questioner for that. If I could now turn to the next speaker, who is Victoria Clark, who will take us through some relevant points on the economy. Vicky.
Thank you. Okay, so yeah, I'm going to move us from Brexit to the coronavirus and start to look a bit in the time we have about what some of the economic consequences and what our view of the outlook is. So just to recap, this is the mid-year update. Since we've had the full lockdown in place on the 23rd of March, we've had a bit of data already. So the UK economy contracted by 2.2% in the first quarter in what was the joint biggest fall since 1979. So, you know, even with a bit of lockdown in place through Q1, we've already had a pretty horrible taste, actually, of some of the coronavirus disruption. And worse was to come. We know that because we've also got monthly GDP figures. Those for April showed the economy dropping by a record 20% over the month alone. And that month had the full weight of the lockdown in place. So, you know, already we know from some of the official figures how severe some of the economic disruptions are. So I want to speak a little bit more about what we're looking at now, what that what the indicators are telling us about where we might be headed, and you know what some of the key drivers are in a little bit more detail. So much of the official data is really telling us a lot about where we've been still. We've had the initial lockdown on the 23rd of March. We had an easing in early May. A lot of the official data that we get from, say, the Office for National Statistics is still telling us a bit more about what happened in that earlier period than what's happening very much at the moment. And clearly things are moving forward every week, every day with regards to the restrictions that are in place. And it is still very much the restrictions which are driving the activity that's happening in the economy at the moment. That still seems to be the critical factor. As the restrictions have moved, we're starting to get a sense as to how activity is adjusting to that. And activity is adjusting. Certainly some of the indirect measures that we look at, which give us a more timely feel for what's going on, point to that pretty clearly. But also they tell us that activity is nowhere near normal. I mean, we're talking about having had a very severe drop in GDP and then activity is starting to resume, and it's resuming pretty well, but there's still lots of the economy that's still very restricted with the new social distancing and other measures in place. It's, you know, it is far from business as usual. A couple of the things we look at pretty closely are electricity consumption and transportation volumes, and there'll be more information, I think, over the weeks ahead when we get, say, restaurants reopening. Things like Open Table are quite useful. They have been in Germany to tell us how much activity is coming back online, but these are much timelier in terms of the response that we're starting to see through. So, you know, if you look at electricity consumption, it was down about 40% at its worst point, and that's come back from there, but it's still very much not back to COVID levels. It's not far off 30% below those sort of pre-COVID levels at the moment. And transportation is a similar story. So, you know, if we look at the HGVs data, that's back to about 92% of pre-COVID levels. So a significant recovery there. But the picture is very varied across the different areas of the transport sector. You look at cars, it's back to about 70%, and trains still down, you know, really kind of down towards the 10% mark. People just aren't, you know, traveling into the big conurbations. And obviously there's repercussions for businesses that are located in and around those areas. So recovery is coming back. It's, you know, as I say, with each day and each week and each material change in restrictions, it is coming back through, but it's still from very low levels, and it is not business as usual. But it, nevertheless, good news, and certainly in terms of our forecast, consistent with the fact that we think that we will get a bus recovery over the months ahead after we get the drop in data that's likely to be recorded in the second quarter. But we're also nervous. One thing that makes us particularly nervous is looking across the Atlantic to the United States, where you had the very forthright reopenings in some of the southern states, you know, Texas in particular, where they went all guns blazing at reopening. And now you've got the very sharp rise in cases, which is leading to a retreat. So, you know, activity is responding, but will we be able to continue to reopen? Will there be a pullback, as we've seen Leicester this week? There's, you know, those sorts of questions continue to linger and will remain critical in terms of driving the economic forecast. And I suppose in that context, you know, one of the key factors for us, as much if not more than the indirect, very timely economic metrics, is the medical data. It's, you know, the buck still stops very much in tracking those coronavirus cases, the reinfection rate, so this R rate that we're hearing a lot about. If that stays below one, each person that catches the virus is infecting less than one other person, then number of cases is tracking down. The government's comfortable to continue reopening and activity can continue to respond. If that goes the wrong way, particularly if NHS capacity starts to become tested, then, you know, the government's going to be more concerned. And other medical aspects are absolutely critical as well. Vaccine development is another one. The International Monetary Fund has said that even if we see a big step forward in the progression of it, we could start to see, you know, economic rewards from that, even, you know, before it's kind of widely affordable. So that's, you know, another critical aspect in the sort of sphere of medical factors, which are very significant. Looking a little bit further ahead beyond the next few months and what's possible in terms of reopening and the activity that's responding, you know, a big question for us, for a lot of the central bankers, is how the second round consequences of all of this come to a head. And, you know, in particular, I'm thinking about the labour market response, how unemployment responds. We've got a huge amount of government support in place. A big plank of that is the coronavirus job retention scheme. Most people know it as the furlough scheme, and that has so far avoided a lot of people that otherwise may have lost their jobs losing them. So as that starts to phase out, particularly in the autumn, will unemployment rise and how much will it rise? Well, we think it will, and we think that peak comes in Q4. So does that then drive a second squeeze on the economy, which, you know, clearly would be unhelpful on top of the, you know, the weight that it's bearing over this year already? So that is significant. Beyond that, we all sort of in the hands of the government waiting to hear a bit more about that. There's going to be an economic update from the Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, next week. Lots of speculation about what more the government might put in place, a VAT cut. Obviously, we had a big speech from Boris yesterday, lots of talk about infrastructure spending, but not much chat about, you know, the return of austerity. So that suggests to us that the government will favour, you know, keeping some of those backstops in place as much as it possibly can afford to. Obviously, the costs are pretty significant. So how does it all fit together? Well, as I've said, as I, you know, kind of continue to emphasise, really, we're getting the recovery in activity. Our best guess, but it depends on the medical data, is that continues, that drives a recovery in Q3. And that GDP overall over this year is probably something like 10% down, maybe a bit more than 10% down, but close to 10% up next year. But that is in the hands of the medical data. And it does, you know, it does constitute a recovery which still sees the economy slowly grinding back to the size that it was in the pre-COVID era. So we wait particularly to see how Saturday pans out, which is the next key phase of the reopening, when we're getting a lot of the restaurants, bars, the hairdressers coming back, and whether the medical data, the COVID cases, the R number, the reinfection rate continue to allow that recovery to carry on through. I will pass back to Phil now, who will hopefully let me know if we've got any questions in at this point.
Yeah, thanks very much, Vicky. That's very comprehensive. There's one brief question, actually a couple, but I'll ask one of them. And that is, how do you think would the economy look a lot worse given if there were a second wave of COVID infections and deaths?
Okay, so it's a really good question. And I think the hunch is that, you know, the economy's already had a significant blow and that, you know, it probably doesn't want to take any more. But if you speak, you know, to the experts, read what the experts are saying, there's suggestions are there that the answer might not be as clear cut as the immediate gut feeling suggests. And a couple of factors really that are worth mentioning on this front. One is that the medical treatment of COVID has improved. You've got this new steroid drug, I hate to say its name, dexamethasone, but that seems to be pretty significant in the treatment of it. And I think for those, and particularly on oxygen, that's cut the death risk quite substantially. So that's important. We don't obviously know how much closer we would be towards a vaccine later in the year, but hopefully, you know, the amount of time that, say, the government needs to buy to get through to that being available would be less. So there's a couple of medical factors that suggest the treatment of it, and also the government's ability to crack down on any COVID hotspots that pop up. Hopefully expertise there has improved. But then, yes, as I said, you know, we've had a significant blow. You know, the government's had a significant blow. Its fiscal position is not what it was at the start of all of this. Would it be reluctant to put the same amount of fiscal support in place second time around? Possibly, though you would imagine there would be an enormous amount of pressure to do that. Also for households, you know, would confidence be hit more? Their financial positions might have less resilience. And the timing of it is, I think, significant as well. I mean, we're hearing a lot of chat that maybe the second wave hits in the autumn, you know, towards the winter, when the NHS is already facing a number of other pressures, the flu season. So, you know, it's not clear cut. Hopefully the medical advances will continue to move us forward, and the government's ability to manage the crisis will be sufficient to offset those downsides that might come from us just being on that less comfortable starting position if we did head into a second wave.
Okay, that's brilliant. Thanks very much, Vicky. It's now time for our next guest, who is Kieran Russell, who will discuss matters on currency markets. Kieran, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks, Phil, and good morning, folks. As Phil mentioned, my name is Kieran, and I work on the Foreign Exchange Risk Management team. I will be focusing on FX markets and will analyse what's been happening to the pound and what is ahead for currency markets in the second half of the year. At the start of the year, currency markets were heavily focused on geopolitical events. In the global sense, it was the US-China trade war, and more locally, it was all about Brexit. The pound would rally on good Brexit news, typically, anything that seemingly reduced the probability of a cliff edge, and would fall on bad Brexit news, anything that would increase the prospect of a no-deal Brexit. Macroeconomic data played second fiddle as a driver for currency markets over this period. So after 3+ years of Brexit wrangling, which cost 2 prime ministers their jobs, saw 2 business Brexit secretaries rather resign, and had us all witness Theresa May's 3 comical attempts at getting the meaningful vote through Parliament, it was certainly a relief for the whole country, regardless of which side of the divide you were on, when the withdrawal agreement bill finally passed through Parliament and was given royal assent. Against this backdrop, and now with our new exuberant Prime Minister in charge, everything seemed to be going swimmingly. As such, sterling reached the lofty heights of 132 against the dollar on 4 occasions in early January, and even touched 120 against the euro either side of the new year. So COVID-19 arrived just as a sense of normality returned to currency markets, and with it, the rulebook had to once again be completely torn up. What really took the market by surprise, or took everyone by surprise really, was the speed at which things progressed. On the 21st of January, in my morning report to clients, I wrote, "It's definitely worth keeping an eye on the outbreak of a deadly coronavirus originating in central China. The outbreak has entered a new phase of severity with multiple medical workers infected and the death count rising to 4 people." Yes, folks, that was January 21st, just 4 reported deaths in China and very little media coverage globally. We're just 2 months later, really, we were in full lockdown, with critics already criticizing Boris Johnson's government that they had taken too long to act. In terms of how currency markets reacted, well, there was indeed chaos. 1 month implied volatility in the sterling dollar options market, for instance, shot up from 5.5% in mid-Feb to 26% a month later by the 19th of March. Now, for those not familiar with implied volatility, it is the measure for quantifying how much the market expects a price of an underlying asset to move. It tells us on an annualized basis how much higher or lower the market expects the rate to be over a certain time period. In this example, a 1 month period. Now, I've worked in markets since 2001, and the only time I've ever recalled seeing 1 month implied vol in cable reaching 20% or above was back when the global financial crisis happened in 2008 and over the 2016 EU referendum. For most of the last 20 years, you'd expect this measure to have sat comfortably beneath the 10% mark. In real terms, what did this actually mean for the pound? Well, against the US dollar, sterling dropped from 132 on the 9th of March to a low of 114.12 in just over a week, even before Boris had a chance to announce his lockdown on the 23rd of March. It was a similar dollar strength story in other currency pairs, for instance. The euro dollar plummeted from 115 back on the 9th of March down to 106.23 on the 23rd of March. It was very clear that we had entered a new world where markets would be driven predominantly by risk on, risk off trading, or RORO trading as we call it. In this environment, the safe haven dollar wins whenever market confidence is shot and loses whenever risk appetite is back on. For the pound, once again, it meant that macroeconomic data releases would have to play second fiddle. In fact, sterling's plight this year has had some commentators mention that the pound has been trading much like an emerging markets currency. Actually, I'd postulate that this price behavior is more a function of the fact that we are in distressed markets. Typically, in these moments, one would see markets start to correlate as investors move out of riskier investments and into safe havens such as bonds, gold, and the safe haven currencies like the yen, Swiss franc, and US dollar. The latter being especially prevalent in the current climate, given the huge stimulus packages that have weakened currencies worldwide. It is therefore not a surprise that the pound's movements have been heavily correlated to movements in equity markets this year, which in turn have been largely determined by investor risk appetite. In fact, it's ironic that in 2020, the pound's fortunes have largely been dependent on good or bad COVID news rather than good or bad Brexit news that we had become so accustomed to. When volatility spikes like this and markets correlate, it completely changes the hedging landscape for corporates. Firms that adopt a portfolio hedging strategy find that certain hedging solutions look more attractive in a high volatility environment than a low volatility environment, and vice versa. I'm not going to go into too much detail here, but corporates, for instance, that are happy to pay a premium to protect a rate at which they purchase their currency into the future, whilst also retaining complete flexibility to walk away from that rate should the market naturally move in their favor, akin to buying insurance, would have found that their premiums would have increased significantly on account of the skyrocketing implied volatility in the market. So the question is, where to from here? Well, to begin, implied volatility in sterling crosses has certainly calmed down since it peaked back in March. As lockdown restrictions have eased, the pound has found itself on a firmer footing, having peaked at 128 against the dollar mid-June, before retracing back to current levels. It's been in the 122 to 124 range this week. Two key events in July that are likely to dictate the next move for sterling are, firstly, the UK's response to a second wave of the virus. We've already seen localized lockdowns in Leicester and the announcement of possible air bridges with nearby European countries too. Whether the government strategies prove effective or not will naturally have strong implications for the pound. Secondly, the chances of the UK agreeing a Brexit deal of some sorts looks to be underpriced according to some traders. And a breakthrough in the deadlock in July would provide a boost for the pound with the possibility of progress. So the possibility of progress cannot be discounted. Although if this weren't to happen, then obviously the pound would continue to struggle. So to summarize, we envisage markets to continue to trade ro-ro as the pandemic is not likely to go away anytime soon. We expect Brexit news to play a part in H220 once more, although perhaps not as large a part as before, given it's been usurped by the severity of COVID. And we warn you not to take your eye off the US-China trade war and the US election later this year. Whilst macro data has taken a back seat, this won't be forever, and we certainly expect fiscal and monetary policy to remain very relevant. Finally, when it comes to FX markets, one cannot take your eye off the technical levels too. So that's a wrap from me, folks. I'm going to hand you back to Phil to see if there have been any questions. But by all means, please feel free to get in touch with myself or a member of the currency team at a later stage too. Phil.
Thanks very much, Kieran. You actually mentioned something towards the end of your talk there, which someone was quite interested in. You sit at a dealing desk day in, day out, or a virtual dealing desk these days. Are there any important technical levels at the moment in terms of the pound?
Sure, that's a good question. I think technicals do play a very important part in how currencies move, and of course there are ones that our traders monitor daily and we pass on to our clients. So just for those who aren't too familiar with technical levels, you basically get resistance and support levels. These are key positions or levels above or below the spot rate where traders would position themselves, and moving averages can often be those levels, sometimes highs and lows, and you know there can be some far more technical ways of looking at Fibonacci retracement levels and so forth. But you know, for me, if you're looking at kind of the next 6 months, we are looking at we've done half year now and we look forward, you know time frames are important when you're looking at support and resistance. So if I were to take a kind of 6 month view, I would probably not look further than the last couple of months. I'd say, you know, resistance on the top for sterling dollar would probably be around the 128.12 mark. I think that was the high back in June. And then on the bottom, I would look at around 120.80, which was the May low. Sterling euro as well, I think, you know, you've got to look at recent ranges and kind of pick the top and bottom. So resistance for me there would be 115.30, which was the April high, I think. And on the downside, you probably could, you know, probably have to go down to as low as 105.25, which was the March low, because clearly we have seen the rate struggle in the last few weeks, and it's down back below 110. So you know, obviously keep close to your Investec dealers and get the levels that are inside of those for shorter term trading. But that's where I see those at the moment.
Okay, that's fantastic. Thanks very much, Kieran. For our next guest, it has to be said that retailing was in the spotlight even before the coronavirus pandemic hit us, and is now very much more centre stage. So I've got a lot of pleasure in introducing Kate Calvert from our equities business, who I introduced a little earlier on, who heads up our retail research. Morning, Kate. Kate, I think you might be still on mute.
Right, can you hear me now, Phil?
Brilliant. Morning.
Great. Okay. Morning. Thanks, Phil. And good morning, everyone. I think, so first of all, to give some context, the retail sector is the largest private sector employer in the UK. It employs 3.1 million people and therefore is a driving force in the economy, as Phil's touched on. About a third of consumer spending goes through retail, which in turn makes up around two thirds of total spending in the economy. 2020 will definitely be regarded as the lost year for the industry. A challenging retail environment is nothing new for the industry. It has had to deal for some time with the structural shift online, which has meant less stores are viable and portfolios need downsizing. This has resulted in a seismic shift in the property market. Over the last 4 years or so, the industry has also faced unseasonal weather patterns, which are perhaps now normal. It's had to deal with inflationary headwinds from the national living wage and the national minimum wage, and also rising sourcing costs post the devaluation of sterling versus the US dollar after the Brexit referendum 4 years ago. When COVID hit, for many retailers, their business literally disappeared overnight. Some were fortunate, some were recognised as essential retailers and able to trade through the lockdown. Some operated in sought-after categories where demand held up reasonably well. But for the majority, they basically had to become online businesses overnight. Online sales typically double, but that has not really been enough to mitigate the lost sales in store. So profits have collapsed. Even those who have seen sales increase over the last 3 months have made no money out of the pandemic. The cost of PPE, staff paying a bonus, and implementing social distancing has been huge. There's definitely been a wide divergence in performance between retailers, depending on the business model and product exposure. Sales trends have improved since the early days of the initial shock. Recent data from the BRC shows that total retail sales fell 6% in May compared to being down 19% in April. Taking the last 3 months, food sales have increased nearly 6% on average, with non-food sales down 22%. So the short-term winners have been infrastructure players like Amazon and Argos, the food retailers, discounters, and in fact, actually anything related to the home, such as DIY and electricals. Fitness and kids have also done extremely well. Where the pain has been felt has been in travel retail, clothing, which has been down over 70%, and big ticket items like furniture and cars. From a corporate perspective, the first priority of all companies has been to batten down the hatches post-lockdown, cut costs and capex. The industry has been in survival mode with the focus on cash preservation and increased financial liquidity, either by looking to increase banking facilities or tap the equity market or even both. The pain has definitely been taken by landlords and suppliers. For example, only around 20% of rents were expected to be collected at the recent June the 24th quarterly rent day. If it wasn't for the government support packages in place, such as the business rates holiday, the coronavirus job retention scheme and various loan schemes, we would have seen many more retailers go into administration, and some good ones at that. As it is, plenty of UK high street net household names have gone into administration, like Debenhams, Bright House and Laura Ashley, to name a few. Admittedly, most of these businesses were already struggling for years and were highly leveraged with weak market positions. We still see three critical hurdles to come in 2020 for the industry. The next hurdle, stage two of survival, is the reopening of stores, which is where we are now. Non-essential retailers could open from the 15th of June in England and Northern Ireland, and obviously Scotland and Wales have followed since. The challenge has been to balance costs and cash with sales, as predicting how quickly sales might come back has been nigh on impossible. For the first few months, most retailers are expecting their store sales to be down between 40 and 60% below normal levels and down about 10% year on year for the rest of the year. What we have seen so far out there is sales down about 50% in the first couple of weeks, so pretty much in line. Footfall is significantly down, and average basket size and conversion is up. What we don't know at the moment is how much of this is pent-up demand, as leisure is yet to reopen, and leisure typically accounts for about 22% of household spending. So the promotional environment also out there has been pretty horrendous and quite aggressive, particularly in clothing, because clothing retailers effectively have missed the whole of the spring-summer selling window. Online demand, the early indications there is that it's starting to fall back from the elevated levels we saw through lockdown, as some sales are switched back to the physical channel. However, we don't expect it to return to the previous levels of penetration pre-COVID, and it was probably going to settle materially above the 30% that it was. The next crunch point or stage three of survival for the sector will definitely be the end of October, when the job retention scheme ends. The timing of this is far from ideal, as it coincides with peak working capital requirements for most retailers, as stock levels around then are at their highest ahead of the all-important Christmas trading period. A decision will need to be made by retailers on how many staff to keep, and that's when we do expect to hear a lot more news on redundancies. And if you work backwards, that most retailers will need to start thinking about this from September, given the minimum collective consultation time. This all coincides with when central government is expecting a second wave. So let's hope there isn't a perfect storm. Stage four of survival is delivering Christmas, and any social distancing as challenges there may impact retailers' ability to process the usual Christmas volumes, and these tend to be very profitable. So looking forward into 2021, we are expecting this to be equally as challenging, with demand likely to struggle to return to pre-pandemic levels, as we expect the macro environment to be very tough. We're certainly expecting a rise in unemployment, as Vicky has already alluded to, and that's likely to weigh heavily on consumer sentiment and impact retail spending. Consumers, we certainly would expect to have to continue prioritising their spending, and there's going to be a wide differential in the performance of non-discretionary and discretionary categories. If the financial crisis is anything to go by, big ticket and home categories are likely to be most affected. And certainly, it took the furniture category at least 3 years to return to growth post the financial crisis. So the newspapers have been full of, is this the death of the high street? And those headlines have been around for a number of years. I think my message is, please don't write off retail. Never let a good crisis go to waste is a very pertinent adage, I feel. Actions taken and investments made by management teams here are very much likely to define the future performance for years to come. And we certainly do disagree with those that say that retail will change forever as a result of the pandemic. Certainly retail is always in a constant state of evolution, and the only constant out there is change. And I think the attributes that make a successful retailer in our mind has stood the test of time, which is very much understanding the customer, staying relevant with a sort of differentiated and very much inspiring offer. What has changed out there is the method of delivery and how demanding consumers have become. So I think on that note, Phil, I'll leave that there and hand back to you.
Okay, thanks very much. That was fascinating. One of the things you mentioned was don't write off retailing. Quick question that we've had is, what do you think the prospects are for physical stores now?
I mean, I think the simple answer there is that there is a role for stores going forward. They still do remain a very critical part of the customer journey, playing a part in about 80% of customer transactions. Customers may be ordering more online, but 60% or so of online orders are typically collected in store. So it is an important channel, and certainly also in terms of returns. I think in terms of formats, I would expect them to continue evolving and to become sort of more of a showcase for products. And I think going forward, I'd expect a lot more technology to be introduced into stores to give a far more sort of interactive, experiential experience going forward. And certainly, I think, you know, if people do want a touch-free experience now, given COVID, I think you're going to start to see your smartphone being used increasingly as well in terms of getting product information and obviously doing transactions, etc. So, yeah, I think there is a role, but obviously, you know, the size of most physical estates will continue to shrink.
Okay, thanks very much indeed. Paul Rablin, our last panelist this morning. We'll move on to you, Paul, who is going to talk about logistics.
Thanks very much, Phil. So I guess logistics, transport, supply chain, whatever you want to call it, is a tough sector, but it's one that we've backed good management teams in over time. And actually, I mean, it feeds in perfectly into the retail story and into the general economic story, given that transport logistics is inherently tied and correlated to the economy. So I guess if I start kind of pre-COVID initially, and some of the secular trends that were being seen within logistics, which are still applicable even post-COVID, are you know, clearly we've talked a lot about the growth in online shopping. We are just buying a lot more on the internet, irrespective of the COVID effect. And the players that have been servicing that that lucrative part of the market have been doing very well. You have just-in-time supply chains, which again is around, you know, retailers holding less stock, product owners holding less stock, and therefore putting more pressure on people within supply chains to stock hold for them. So just in time is absolutely a trend that's been happening. Brexit, you know, we've already talked about blocks, holdups, requirements for storage and stocking, which is kind of almost a, bizarrely an opposite effect to just in time supply chains where players are trying to destock. But effectively that puts more pressure on the supply chain. And I guess underlying all of that is consolidation within the market. As I kind of said, it is a tough market. You know, larger players are acquiring and combining smaller players. A number of reasons for that, whether it's to buy effectively or to acquire added value services, to increase margins, to boost economies of scale, because logistics is inherently a price, you know, it can be quite price driven. You know, if you're a bigger player, you have higher economies of scale, you can resist price pressure. But also a key trend exacerbated somewhat by Brexit has been skills shortages and input cost inflation, in particular around labor. You know, the EU nationals do make up a big chunk of the logistics materials handling supply chain. And if you believe the news, something like 40,000 drivers, HGV drivers, have left the UK, supposedly. So what does that do? That increases cost pressure within players, logistics providers within the supply chain, which ultimately means that the supply chain becomes more expensive. I mean, this is a mission critical part of the country. And depending on which side of the line you sit, you could argue that that's now becoming more appropriately valued because it is so mission critical. But certainly costs there will be going up because of those trends. Now, if you take this through COVID, in many ways, and COVID has exacerbated, has accelerated certain trends that have been happening anyway, and logistics is no exception, albeit it has created new dynamics depending on what part of the market you're serving, whether you're what function stage or end market you're in. And if I kind of take it a step back initially and just think about the macro, I suppose initially as part of COVID, you've had a shockwave go through the system, whereby initially this was a supply side issue, particularly for goods coming in from China, where actually warehouses in the UK and the Western world were potentially emptying, but logistics were still pretty busy, which has then actually flipped. As you've now got a demand issue within the Western world, but actually China is back producing again. So actually you've got warehouses now filling back up, but logistics potentially moving forward, becoming less busy as demand has kind of somewhat evaporated, albeit that is now coming back through. So I guess to kind of echo what Vicky said earlier, you know, I would absolutely agree with the bounce back in terms of volumes. You know, I think general goods volumes across the UK are back at kind of 80-90% of pre-COVID, certainly what we're seeing. You know, the fact that, to Kate's point, shops, pubs opening, you know, that re-engages a large portion of the infrastructure that has been sitting idle. So actually, there are positives here. And of course, certain players have been very, very busy all the way through. If you service Amazon or if you service, you know, the online part of the market, and you're moving gym equipment, garden furniture, white goods for all of that extra food that you've stockpiled. So I think there are winners and losers overall. I think, you know, specialist providers have been somewhat polarized given, you know, they can be quite niche in the aspects that they serve. So if you have specialist equipment, but that particular part of the market is completely closed, then I'm afraid you've really got nowhere to run. Albeit the guys in e-commerce have been doing quite well. And actually, you know, where you have value-added services around particular delivery slots, for example, during COVID, that became irrelevant because everyone was at home. So actually, you cannot charge extra for, you know, a very specific delivery slot. That advantage effectively evaporates. And I think my kind of overall comment on this is that actually it has exposed inflexibility within the supply chain in the sense that if you can imagine that logistics networks are set up and contracts are pitched on the basis of a particular route being profitable. And if actually you get a closure, albeit a temporary closure from a customer in a particular part of the country, that could make an entire contract or entire route unprofitable overnight. So what has that done? That's actually encouraged and engendered the improvement of flexibility, lateral thought, the use of subcontractors, the use of other people's infrastructure, the almost the Uber model, whereby you're using someone else's metal to move stuff around. So actually, asset light networks have benefited out of the crisis, and it has encouraged flexibility to develop and collaboration, crucially. But I would kind of sound a note of caution around that, in the sense that someone does have to own the asset. So there does need to be warehouse owners and metal owners. So actually, you know, asset light models inherently rely on asset heavy constituent parts as well. So those guys need to survive. And look, hopefully some of the lessons and some of the flexibility that's been developed through COVID can be taken through post COVID. That would be my kind of final comment and observation. And Phil, back to you in case there have been any questions.
Yeah, thanks very much, Paul. There's an awful lot of food for thought in that. We have got one question, a couple, but I'll just ask the first one, which is, you know, given hopefully that activity will continue to increase in the economy, what do you identify as perhaps being the key risks in transport and logistics?
Yeah, I think on the face of it, you're quite right. I think things should be improving now, and actually volumes are increasing, and that's positive. I think the key point is around, and this was a bit similar with Brexit. It was exactly the same in terms of the amount of warehousing space you need. Do I resource up for a peak only for the peak to dissipate? I think that is the key challenge within logistics, transport, supply chain. And businesses are going to have to think very, very carefully around that, in the sense of, you know, we are seeing a bounce back, but do I employ all those people, you know, permanently, if that then comes back off again and we're in a long protracted recession, which we all hope we're not going to be. I think that's a key aspect. I think also what's definitely not gone away, and it's to one of the points that Kate raised around, certainly around the furloughing scheme and the end of certain government schemes coming through. I think you do have a long tail of smaller players, small, medium-sized players across the country, and in fact across Europe, that kind of underpin the various networks. And actually, a lot of those players don't necessarily have deep pockets. So actually, as government schemes come to an end, there is a concern, I think, around liquidity. And actually, if those players are allowed to go to the wire, then that could then have a, you know, almost a domino effect. So I don't think the liquidity point has gone away. In fact, you know, with the increase of the increase of liabilities on balance sheet, this is an issue. But absolutely, it's something that we're very mindful of in the aspects that we think about when we're lending to businesses as well.
Great. Thank you very much. We do have a few questions being asked by people attending, and I will go through a couple of them. I think we've got a time for two or three. The first one, Paul's just mentioned the economy, and indeed one of the questions is on the shape of the recovery. So I'm going to direct this one to Victoria. What are the panel's views on the Bank of England's latest report that they see a V-shaped recovery in the economy, and at least that it's now possible? Vicky?
Yep, I'm here. Thanks, Phil. So the Bank of England, for a while, as actually many economists, including ourselves, have been talking about the shape of recovery in terms of letters of the alphabet. So, you know, is it going to be V, a sharp down and a sharp up, or a U with a shallow bottom and then the recovery, or God forbid, you know, an L-shaped recovery? And I think this question is picking up on the comments that we heard from the chief economist at the Bank of England yesterday, where he's saying that he's more confident now that it's going to be a V-shaped recovery. The bank for a while has been talking a little bit more in a slightly more nuanced way, actually, about, you know, people's bad handwriting, in the sense that I think he's talking more about a lopsided V than a very nice neat V. So the recovery comes, the drop in output comes down, and then the recovery comes, but it doesn't bring the economy back to where it was pre-crisis. But yes, he's talking yesterday again about more confidence in it being some sort of V-shaped recovery. And that reflects the sentiment that's coming through in the data that I mentioned, where the activity data is coming back through. I think there's been particular surprise at the extent to which consumption has picked up, and households have been willing to get out there and spend. And that perhaps reflects some data that we saw yesterday, where the saving rate for households has been quite solid because they haven't been able to spend over the lockdown period. So I think that's significant, but also the fact that the reopening has come more rapidly than they expected. But much like everybody else, you know, as I said, they're really at the perils of the medical data and the evolution of the virus. So at the moment, they're more confident. That's based on these most recent factors. But if those fall off track, if more lockdowns come through, then they'll shift their view accordingly.
Thanks, Vicky. When you mentioned bad handwriting, why do I think you're talking about me? Right, we move on to the next question now. And this is one directed towards Kate. What type of retailers or products sold will you think will do well on the high street in the future? Kate. Sorry, Kate, I think you're on mute.
I think I'm having a slight technical problem here. Okay, I'm here. Yeah, in terms of products that are likely to do well on the high street, I mean, I think you're going to categories which have already shifted quite significantly towards online are things like electricals and sort of more everyday items, you know, the classic sort of things you can see on Amazon, a lot of the leisure things and stuff like that. In terms of the high street, I mean, I think people still want to feel and touch stuff. So clothing, for example, and I actually think quite a lot of the homeware stuff would also continue to do well on the high street. So, you know, I think we're going to continue to see very much quite a similar high street to what we've got at the moment. But I think what you will see is that the brands will shrink away quite materially, particularly in that sort of mid-market clothing sector where there's a whole sea of sameness. I would certainly expect a lot of that to start disappearing.
Okay, thank you very much. We have time for one more question, and I think we're going to go back to Paul for this one. And the question is, given supply chain issues with global manufacturing coming primarily from the Far East, do you see this changing? And the questioner has talked about just-in-time management highlighting some of these issues. Paul?
I think that's a really good question. I think there's no secret that and this was also part of the Brexit thing as well, in terms of people, the desire to hold more stock nearby because of Brexit. We saw that with a lot of our clients stocking up to cope with that potential issue or the issues at the border, and I think that will be relevant for Brexit. I think it's also relevant in terms of some of the fallout that's happened post COVID and you know, the reliance on China in particular for manufacturing goods. I think what you will see is more stockholding onshore. We are definitely seeing that with certain clients of ours. That are now actively working on bringing, you know, increasing their storage capacity within the UK, and that then filling up so that we don't have similar issues in the future. So I do see that as, I think it was happening anyway somewhat because of Brexit, but I think that will continue. And what that means then is that actually, you know, if you are, you will be holding stock nearby to your store or to your factory or wherever it might be. I don't think that changes just in time per se, in terms of, you know, the perspective from the retailer or the manufacturer, but it continues the importance on the supply chain manager or the logistics or the warehousing manager, because the importance of that part of the market will increase. And I think that, you know, that will, the demand for that type of space will increase as a result.
Great. Thank you very much, Paul. I think that wraps up the first of our fortnightly webinars. Just a word of thanks to all of our panel and, of course, to yourselves for attending. The final point is that we're going to be sending out a survey to each of you. So you'll be able to make some comments on the audio quality, for example, and the content. And also you'll be able to sign up for invitations to future events. So thanks very much for attending, and we'll see you soon. Goodbye.